name's Bob Darrow, and I am alcoholic.
Bob.
And I'm sober today only through the grace and the power of God in the program, in the people, and in the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. And because I'm in Texas, I have to tell you that I've been sober since August 29th, 1978. Thank you. I knew there'd be somebody in here that knew what day it was. It's good to be here. I'm curious, sir, do you allow Al-Anons to come to your conferences down here? Are there any Al-Anons in the room? Do you raise your hand? Don't be ashamed. Okay. Welcome. About 12 years ago, as a result of service in Alcoholics Anonymous and starting to sponsor people and getting on committees, I ended up a whimpering newcomer in Al-Anon also. And I've been attending those meetings ever since. You know why so many alcoholics end up marrying Al-Anons? Well, they finally found someone who thinks about them as much as they do. That's not a joke, that's the truth. I'd like to welcome anybody who's reasonably new. I'm real glad you're here. As a matter of fact, if you're sitting at this convention as a newcomer, like I sat in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was a newcomer, I'm probably more glad you're here than you are. Because if you're like I was, finding yourself in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous does not feel like the high point of your life. I don't know about you, but I don't think we're the kind of people that sit down at beginning of the 11th year of high school with our guidance counselor and say, well, I'm going to flunk out of some of the best schools in the United States and end up an alcoholic in Alcoholics Anonymous. Coming here is not my idea. Matter of fact, coming to Alcoholics Anonymous for me was the last thing I tried. I tried a lot of things before coming here. All kinds of psychotherapy and transcendental meditation. I think I did everything from Ram Dass to Rum Dum before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I held out to the very last to come here, just to find that this is where I should have came all along. This is where I belonged, because I have the disease of alcoholism. And if you're new, there's a lot of things that make a lot of sense in the world that when it comes to alcoholism just don't make any sense at all. There's a lot of things in normal everyday living that would be considered assets that when it comes to alcoholism are liabilities. There's a lot of things in normal everyday living that are considered liabilities, and when it comes to alcoholism are assets. In the normal world, if you have a family that will never desert you and they'll keep sticking by your side and they'll keep bailing you out and they're always there for you, that would be considered an asset. When it comes to alcoholism, it's a liability. In the normal world, if you have a business or if you have a job that is real secure, and no matter what you do, there's no danger of you ever losing it, that would be considered an asset. When it comes to alcoholism, it's a liability. In the normal world, if you're very intelligent and intellectual and a deep thinker, that would be considered an asset. Believe me, when it comes to alcoholism, it's a liability. You can smell our original thinkers here. One of the things you guys taught me about the disease of alcoholism is that it is a disease. And it can only be cured, it can only be dealt with in a state of absolute abstinence. So I was told that the name of the game becomes, I don't drink no matter what. I don't drink if my old lady sleeps with the trash man. I don't drink if I sleep with the trash man. I don't drink. And in a state of absolute abstinence, a guy like me could come to rooms like this and I can find a way to go. You know, alcoholism is the only disease I know of that uses the person who has the disease, his own mind, against them. And I think a lot of us, anybody who's been here for a while, has seen a lot of really decent people die of this disease. And it never happens intentionally. We're some of the most best intentioned people in the world. And I've never done anything in my life that has ended up destroying me thinking that it was going to destroy me. It just was one of those deals that just seemed like a good idea at the time. And there's something about my alcoholism that keeps setting me up for stuff like that. And a lot of my ideas almost hurt me. And one of the things that hurts me more than my ideas is some of the answers I come up with for the problems that occur in my life. See, my solutions have never worked. And it was real hard for me to get to a point inside myself where I knew that I can't run my own life anymore. You know, if there's anybody here that's been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, I really want to welcome you here. And I feel the most close to you because I was one of those people that was in and out for a number of years. I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of an institution I was in 1971. And I was just a kid. I don't think I was barely old enough to take a legal drink in the state I was living. And I went there because I was in a lot of trouble. I was in trouble in my life, in my family. I was in trouble where I'd lost a job, I'd lost a relationship, I'd lost some friends, I'd done some embarrassing, degrading things, I'd owed a lot of money, the heat was really on me, I'd been arrested a couple times, and my life was just I was almost on the skid row. And you know, they told me in this treatment center, and I heard it in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous while I was in there, and I've heard it numerous times over the years, that alcoholism is a progressive disease. But there's something about me that thinks that that only applies to you, right? And I was one that was lucky enough to survive my own progression of my disease and watch it progress in my life. And from 1971 to 1978, when I finally came here, broken enough to stay, I watched things happen in my life, and I watched myself do things that no human being should ever do. And you know, this disease, if you're like I am and you keep practicing and you're unprotected, it'll take you places that, or you can't, take you places and have you doing things where you can't stand yourself anymore. And as a matter of fact, it gets so bad, it gets to points where if you're like I am, you think, if I could just feel better and get on my feet, I think I'd kill myself. Almost as if suicide was a step up. And, you know, in the years that I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, most of the time I didn't really want to be at meetings. And I would come to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would sit in the back of the room on my throne of contempt in the inventory section, where, if you're like I am, that's the only place you can sit. And I would sit back there and I would listen to the speakers and I would look at the people and I would look for the differences and I would judge you. And the more I listened to you, the further I got away from you and the more different I felt. And I've come to understand that alcoholism is a disease of separation. The ism of alcoholism is something about my sickness where I separate myself from you. And I sat in meetings, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't feel like I fit. And I never really listened. See, the bottom line is that inside me, I felt uncomfortable here. I didn't feel like I was enough. I didn't feel like you people. I looked around AA and there was nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous that seemed to look the way I felt. Now I'd come to AA off the streets I'd either be in a county jail or at a Salvation Army or in a hospital detox, and I'd be coming into AA meetings and I would see people in Alcoholics Anonymous who looked very comfortable and very successful, and I would sit in the back of the room and I'm just hanging on by my fingernails. I'm not drinking, but I don't feel happy about it. You know, I used to identify with W.C. Fields. He said, I was sober once. It was the most boring 45 minutes of my whole life. Right? And I would stop drinking, and something else was wrong with me, and I didn't understand what it was. I'd stop drinking, and it felt like I was doing time. And if you've ever sat in a county jail waiting to get out, you know what I'm talking about. And my alcoholism starts where the bottle ends. And the minute I stopped drinking, I felt like a fish out of water. And I'd sit in the back of the meetings, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd watch the people and how they'd laugh and get along with each other, and they just seemed to fit so well. And they seemed to enjoy themselves, and there were people with various degrees of sobriety, anywhere from 1 month or 2 months to 20, 30 years. And I would look at them, and I just felt so out of place. And I didn't know what it was. You know, prior to going on my last drunk, I was the last place I ended up was a Skid Row mission in the north side of Pittsburgh. It was run by a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he used to make me go to AA meetings on the outside, one a week, which I really thought was extreme. And this is how the alcoholic mind works. I went to him one time. I went into his office, and I said, I got to talk to you about this A&A stuff. I know you get government funding, and I don't think you can send me to this AA because it's some kind of religious thing. They pass the basket, and they say the Lord's Prayer, and they talk a lot about God. And I know somewhere it says in the Constitution that I have my religious freedom. I don't think you can make me go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he looks at me with that kind of look that people in AA give you when you're a newcomer, you know? And he's laughing at me, and it's like there's something funny, and you don't know what it is, and you're the only one in the room, right? And he says to me, yeah, you're right. You don't have to go to AA, but you don't have to stay here. Now, there's about 2 feet of snow on the ground, and I can be a flexible guy. Besides, I knew if I told him I'd go to those meetings, he'd feel better. So I agreed to go to those meetings. And this one night, they're putting us in the bus. And they had this van, and they'd put us all in there, and they'd take us to this meeting. And they used to take us to this one big group. About 150 people there. It was Friday night. Everybody's all dressed up. The guys all had suits on, the women dresses, and the jewelry. And they just drove there in their new cars. And, geez, they looked like them. You know? You know who them are. And there was nobody in those meetings that looked like I would have drank with them. There's some people there I'd look like I'd like to know where they lived and when they weren't going to be home. But there's nobody there that looked like I would have drank. They looked to me like people who maybe had a martini too many on the golf course, said something embarrassing to their boss, and came to AA for better business connections, right? And I'm walking into this meeting with the whole crowd of people. We're the stupid, boring, and glum lot, you know, the ones that come in and never smile and sit in the back of the room. And I got hair down to about here. I got this beard that I haven't trimmed since it started to grow. I got clothes on that they gave me in this place where I'm living. I had check pants and check shirts on, and the checks don't match. Hey, I was in L.A. not too long ago. That's a fashion statement there, let me tell you. And I'd sit in the back of the room, and I'd look at all these people, and there's nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous that I feel comfortable around. And at this one particular meeting, there was a guy, and he's giving a pitch, and he's celebrating 10 years of sobriety. And I'd never seen anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous that looked like this man. I'd seen a lot of people in the halfway houses and in the detoxes and in the places I ended up that looked like him, but I never saw anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous that looked like him. And he had long hair and a beard. And because of the way he looked like someone I might have drank with, and because of that, and only because of that, I listened to him. And I heard him say some things that probably were said in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that I was in the room 100 times, but I never heard it because I couldn't hear. But I heard this man, and he said some things that really hit me. And he talked about drinking until he passed out and then going to the bathroom on himself. And that used to happen to me a lot, and I was mortified by it. And I didn't want anybody to ever know. He talked about that feeling when he'd walk down the street on his way to the liquor store to get a bottle of wine, the feeling like everybody was looking at him. And I knew what that felt like. And I used to sometimes feel raw, like all my nerves were exposed, like everybody was staring at me. Because I felt so dirty inside and so much full of shame. Even made a joke about it. He said he had to stop going to football games because when the team got in the huddle, he knew they were talking about him. When he said that, I almost laughed, but I was sober. When you're sober, you don't laugh at anything. And I listened to this guy, and there was a lot of... The guy that ran the place that I was living was always pressuring me to get a sponsor. And I knew what he really wanted. He wanted me to ask him so he could put another notch on his big book, right? And I'd rather die than ask that SOB. But here was this guy, and I thought to myself, you know, if I ever really did need to talk to somebody, maybe I could talk to this guy. And I went up to him after the meeting, and he's standing up in the front of the room, and there's about four or five guys, and they're standing around laughing and joking like people do in AA. And as I'm walking up to him to ask him to be my sponsor, something started to choke up inside me, and I couldn't ask him. And I didn't understand at the time what was going on. I understand now. You see, I subconsciously thought that other people must surely feel about me the way that I do. And I was afraid because of that I would ask him to be my sponsor and he'd look at me and reject me and with something like, what are you crazy, me sponsor a parasite like you? So I couldn't ask him. Instead I walked up to him and I said, my name's Bob, how'd you stay sober 10 years? And he looked me right in the eye and he said, I didn't drink. Now, up until that moment, I kind of liked that guy. But he really hit a nerve with me. And it was a nerve that I didn't want to look at. And the nerve was that I had a secret. And it's the secret that kept me the most separate from you. And the secret was that I wasn't like you because I didn't have what it takes to not drink. See, I'd been sober a lot of times. I'd been sober over and over again. And I couldn't get like you guys could get. You stopped drinking and got happy. You know, it used to seem to me that people would get up to get chips. Now, you got to understand that the eyes and ears I was hearing with in those days were a little distorted, but it appeared to me that people would get up to the meeting in the meeting, and they'd take a 6-month chip, and they'd say, 6 months ago I was eating out of the dumpster in back of the Alano Club, and now I'm the president of United States Steel or something like that, you know? And it's like, I'm trying to figure out where I'm going to get another cigarette, right? And when this guy said, when I asked him how he stayed sober 10 years, and he said, I didn't drink, I just kind of hung my head and turned and walked away from him because I knew what he was talking about. And I knew that, yeah, a guy like that can do that. But there was something else wrong with me, and I didn't have what it takes to not drink. And if you're new, please hear this. It never occurred to me that I was like you. It never occurred to me that you didn't have what it takes to not drink either. See, all I did was I judged my insides, my untreated alcoholism, with the outward manifestation of the program of recovery in your life. And see, I'm a real alcoholic. And as a real alcoholic, I'm incapable of staying dry with untreated alcoholism for any sustained period of time. I get to a point where I have no mental defense against my own emptiness. I would get to a point continuously in the years that I was in and out over and over, no matter how much I tried, no matter how much determination, no matter how much enthusiasm I tried to manufacture for not taking a drink, I would eventually get to the point where I would have it just about up to here with being sober. And I would get to a point where I would feel that if I don't take something to change the way I feel, I'm going to lose my mind. And when I would get to that point, it didn't matter that if I took a drink meant I was going to prison. It didn't matter if I was going to get kicked out on the streets. It didn't matter what was going on and what was hanging over my heads. When I would get to that point, I would eventually drink. And I had no power over that. And I had no control over that. And I would do it time and time again, and every time I did it and failed, I felt that much more worthless and that much more like I didn't fit here. Because I watched you guys, and you seemed to have that, whatever it was, that missing piece. And I didn't have it. And I didn't understand that you didn't have it either, that you came here and you got it. You know, in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about step one two different ways. And most people in meetings, you hear them talk about you hear it mentioned the way it talks about it in chapter 5, and where it lists the 12 steps. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, our lives had become unmanageable. But the way I like it, it says it a different way in chapter 3, and it fits me a little bit better. And the way it says it in chapter 3 is, it says we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were real alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. And the reason that comes more true to me is that in the years that I was in and out of treatment centers and in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, I could admit that I was an alcoholic. I could admit that I was powerless over alcohol. I could admit just about anything to fit, to get your acceptance and to get the heat off me. And I could even admit it, you know, I could go through these classes that they'd have in these treatment centers, and they'd show you the movies, and they'd teach you all about alcoholism, and I could sit and I could watch that stuff, and I could say, yeah, I can see that. Yes, I understand that. And I bet you, if you would have put me on a lie detector and asked me if I believed I was a real alcoholic, I bet you I would have said yes, and I bet you it would have said I was telling the truth. And yet I really didn't believe it down inside my innermost self. I hadn't accepted it. And you know how I can tell looking back? Because what happened with my feet? I didn't walk like someone who knew they were powerless. I talked like I was. But what I really acted like was someone that could beat this thing on their own. What I really acted like was someone who had this thing under control. And I had a tough time. And all I can tell you what happened to me is coming off my last drunk in 1978, I ended up one more time in a hospital. And something had just broke inside of me. And I didn't think I was going to stay sober because of it. What it felt like is, it felt like all the initiative, all the positiveness, everything that was in me was beaten out of me, like there was nothing left. And because of that feeling of brokenness that I had, and I didn't think I had a chance at staying sober. I didn't think I had a shot. See, I was under the illusion that I didn't drink, that I kept drinking again because I wasn't positive enough, because I wasn't pumped up enough, because I didn't have enough determination. See, I'd go through a treatment center, or I'd end up in a county jail all beaten up, and I'd get all pumped up with the knowledge that I know where I went wrong, I'm never going to drink again. And I'd kind of be like a balloon that you blow up full of air, and then when I'd get out, it'd be like letting that balloon go, and I'd go like hell for a while. And then I'd run out of gas. And when I run out of gas, I got to take a drink. And when I run out of gas, I can't stand my own emptiness. And when I run out of gas and I can't put the positive thinking between me and my disease anymore, then the waves of shame and guilt start coming back. And all those feelings like I don't fit. And I start once again feeling like a fish out of water. And I can't stand that for very long. And this time things were different. This time I was just broken. And I didn't think I'd stay sober. And people in Alcoholics Anonymous at that time in Las Vegas told me to do the same things I guess I'd heard 100 times. Get a sponsor, start talking to God every day, go to a meeting every day, stick out your hand to someone, read the big book, start getting into the steps, all the things that everyone hears in Alcoholics Anonymous. But this time the difference was I just started doing it. You know, before, there were some attempts in the years that I was in and out. There were some honest attempts at staying sober. And where I would give it my very best shot, I'd give it 120%, and I'd fail. But I would approach it with the attitude of, okay, I'm done. I'll do anything to stay sober that seems reasonable to me. See, some of you understand that. All right? And the problem with that is, as long as I used my mind to try to figure out my plan of attack on this disease, I kept getting the same results. I would have been better off getting Charles Manson as a sponsor. All right? And this time, in my brokenness, when you told me to do something, I just went and did it. I didn't do it with a lot of enthusiasm. I just went and did it. And you guys told me to do certain, you know, thank God that I fell into the hands of the people I fell into the hands of. And I fell into the hands of members of Alcoholics Anonymous who were very active in service and believed only in the principles in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. They didn't really care for too much else. And I'm so glad I fell into their hands, because in my brokenness, I was probably willing to follow just about anything. If I would have fallen into the hands of the Hare Krishnas, I might be at the LA airport today, right? And I fell into the hands of these people. And they started encouraging me to take the actions of recovering members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was encouraged to form four habits when I was new. And those habits have saved my life. And I believe that if I wouldn't have formed those four habits in my life, I wouldn't have survived my disease long enough to eventually have gotten into a fourth step as it's outlined in the book, and the fifth, and to make amends, and to develop a more deep conscious contact with God. I wouldn't have stayed sober long enough. And those four habits, the first habit was the meeting habit. And they told me that if there was a meeting going on somewhere around, and I didn't absolutely have to be somewhere else, that I was to be there, and that I was to average at least one meeting a day, no matter what. And they even defined what a meeting was. They said, you have to go 10 minutes early, at least, and talk to someone, and stay 10 minutes late. And they told me that I couldn't count meetings in the detox I'd just gotten out of. And the second habit was the God habit. They told me that I get down on my knees every morning and I ask whoever's running this universe for the power to stay sober for that day, and while I'm asking him, to know that I do not have it. And at the end of the day, to thank whoever was running that universe for that gift of sobriety for that day. And the third habit was the transparency habit, that every day I share with another member of Alcoholics Anonymous what's going on inside of me with my feelings and my thinking, and what's going on outside of me with jobs, finances, relationships, and that I stay real current with that. And the last habit, and probably the most important, it's also our third legacy, was the habit of service. And I was told to try to do some sort of service every day. And in the beginning, it was to be service in Alcoholics Anonymous, like helping the secretary clean off the tables after a meeting. And when I was 3 weeks sober, I was told to find people that were 1 week sober and to go up and welcome them to meetings. Because I was so new, that I might be the only person in the room that knew what it felt like to be the new kid on the block, to knew what it felt like to sit in a meeting and shake and not fit. And because of that, it was my job to reach out to those new people and just to help them feel welcome. And later to become a secretary of a group and to do whatever Alcoholics Anonymous asked me to do. And that's become an important part of my sobriety. And I still do those four habits today. And I really, if I wouldn't have, you know, there, I don't know how it is down here. I think it's a little different, but in some of the bigger cities, you have these little cliques of AA, and some of them don't believe in certain parts of the program, or they have these modified versions of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I've been to meetings where I felt really kind of like I didn't fit. See, I guess it's because of my childhood. I kind of felt like maybe I was deprived because I didn't come from an alcoholic home. I never got to move in the middle of the night. And the only violence I ever saw as a kid was on Gunsmoke. But in Alcoholics Anonymous today, sometimes I see a lot of things going on that if they were going on when I was new, I think it would have deluded me and sidetracked me from the things that were necessary to save my life. And I am one who believes in the actions outlined in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was sober a few months, my sponsor was prodding me gently to work in the steps. And he gets on these kicks. I think there's a school for sponsorship somewhere out in the desert in Nevada where they teach them this stuff behind barbed wire fences or something, you know. And there was about a long period of time where no matter what was going on in my life, no matter what was happening, no matter what the problem was, no matter if it was good, if it was bad, no matter what, my sponsor had one answer and one answer only. Go read page 60 through 63 of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can't tell you how many dozens and dozens of times that I read that. And when I first started reading it, I would read it, and then I would go to my group, and I'd look around, and I could see how people in that group were really self-centered. You know? And I'd think, boy, I'm glad he has me reading this. You know? I'll tell you, it's a tough, lonely business when God's given you that divine awareness of how everybody is, that sense of urgency to tell them, but of course the humility to know better. And I'd read that part of the book, and I could see it in you guys, and I couldn't see it in myself. And then one day, I can't even tell you what was going on, but I was in a real bad space, and I was real uptight and real uncomfortable. And I went to him, and he said, he started to tell me, I said, yeah, I know, read page 60 through 63. And I went home and I started reading it. And for the first time, I could put it on and wear it. And when it talked about the actor who wanted to run the whole show, was forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way, they were describing the whole day I just lived through. And not only that, I got a glimpse of how my whole life was condensed right in that part of the book. The thing that kept getting me at odds with everything and everybody, there's a line in there that I've come to love. It describes my whole life. It says, we are victims of the illusion that we can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if we only manage well. And that's the story of my life. And alcoholism is a disease of conflict. And through my own need to gratify myself and fill up my own emptiness, I have constantly and continually put myself at odds with everything and everybody. And never once on purpose. You know, there's been this driving force inside of me that I've come to understand as part of my alcoholism that's driven me before I ever took my first drink. You know, far back before I ever drank, I had that feeling like I didn't quite fit. And I was always trying to treat that. And I always seemed to have this sense of urgency in my life and this feeling that wherever I was, I really needed to be somewhere else. And wherever that somewhere else was, if I went there, after being there for a while, it wasn't there either. It had to be someplace else. And I've come to discover there's something wrong with me. It's part and parcel of this disease of alcoholism. One of my earlier memories, I was about probably 7 years old, 6 years old, and I was hanging around with a bunch of kids. And we used to meet after school, and we used to choose up sides and play cowboys and Indians and ball and that kind of stuff. And looking back, I can see that I was very well accepted with this group of guys. But you know, I never felt like I was. I always felt like I was coming from behind. Like I just didn't quite measure up, like I wasn't enough. There was a piece missing out of me. And, you know, it occurred to me one day that if I had a set of those pearl-handled Hopalong Cassidy six guns, that I would really be somebody with those guys, right? And I connived and manipulated and schemed my parents into getting me a set of those. And I remember we had a mirror in the hallway before you went outside the house. And I remember putting them on and standing, looking in the mirror, getting ready. And if you're an alcoholic, you've spent a lot of your life getting ready, you know. And I'm getting ready. And I know this is going to be it. You know, this is going to be it. And I got these six guns, and I go out to the vacant lot where we meet, and I'm showing these guys and these six guns, and I'm strutting around, and this is great. And then about 2 minutes later, everything goes back to the way it was, and they're choosing up sides, and something's wrong. And I went home that day, and I sat in the backyard by the garage, and I looked at those guns, and I, in a fit of anger, I took them and I smashed them on the ground. And I smashed them on the ground because I thought they'd let me down. I smashed them on the ground, and I sat with those six guns like I've sat probably 1,000 times in my life, with wads of $100 bills and new cars, with women in motel rooms, with bottles of liquor, with new jobs, new relationships, new towns, wondering what happened. And the demoralization at that point, and all those points in my life, is always the same. See, because I'm a victim of the illusion that I can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if I just manage well. You know, what is it about me? If I see someone that's happy and I get everything that they have, how come I don't feel like they look? And what I've come to understand is that alcoholism and the thing that has driven me all my life is an inside disease, and it takes an inside answer. After I'd been reading page 60 through 63 of the Big Book for some period of time, I got together with my sponsor and said the prayer on page 63 of the Big Book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And shortly after that, I was told that it was time to do a fourth step, and I went to the Big Book on Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm reading in the Big Book about the section on the fourth step, and I don't understand it. And I go back to my sponsor, and I said, well, I'm ready to do a fourth step. What do I do? And he says, read the Big Book. Now, I've been reading the Big Book. Now, I'm sober long enough to have just enough self-esteem. Now, I cannot bring, I got, my pride has returned, and I can't tell my sponsor that I've been reading the Big Book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't know what it says. Now, and I don't know who the hell Mr. Brown is and Mrs. Jones and all these people. And it's, you know, it's like, it's English, but it doesn't help. Right? I don't know what it means. It's, and I'm reading this, and I can't, I swear to God, I can't understand what to do. And I can't tell him that. I just can't bring myself to tell him that. So I did it my way, right? So I wrote 40 pages of this gruel about everything I was ever ashamed of and everything I felt bad of for doing, and I, all the guilt and all this stuff. And I cornered my sponsor for about 8 hours in this room, and I made him listen to all this gruel. And you know something? He didn't drink. And when it was all over, my sponsor's a very, very loving man, and he knew that I struggled with this for a long time. And he couldn't tell me that I did it wrong. He couldn't tell me that that I wasn't any good. What he did tell me was, he said, maybe you'll find at some time in the near future, you may find the desire to go back and do another fourth step. And if that comes about, you may want to try to use the outline that's in the Big Book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I guess, see, the problem with what I did, I wrote down my whole life story. I used the rationalization in the beginning of chapter 6. It says our whole life story, and I figured that's what I did. I wrote my whole life story out. But you know something? I missed it because there was nothing I put down there that was new. See, I knew all the stuff I was putting down there. I mean, when I did the fifth step with my sponsor, it was good because I got a lot of things off my chest. And that was good. I had some secrets I'd never shared with anybody, and that was real good. But as far as the 180-degree turn that people talked about in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was missing it. And a few years went by, and finally, when I was about 4.5 years sober, I'd been, for the first 4.5 years of my sobriety, I'd been an active member of a Big Book study group, and I it finally started to hit me how to do a fourth step as it's outlined in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd gotten to a point where I knew I had to do another fourth step. You know how I knew? Because every meeting I went to, that was the subject. And so I sat down and I did one exactly as it's outlined in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I always mention this because this was a very big turning point in my recovery. And I know that there are members in Alcoholics Anonymous, sober members in good standing, sober a long time, that have never done it like that. And if you're open-minded, hold on to the idea that maybe, just maybe, you might be shortchanging yourself. See, when I did the fourth step, as it's outlined in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, I started to tap into the process of the 180-degree turn. So basically, most of you guys know from the book that it tricks you. It has you write down everybody you've ever been burned up at or resentful for. And I don't know about anybody else, but I got all that stuff on file, you know? And I wrote down all that stuff, and then it tells you to put down the cause, what they did to me, and oh, I can get that on file too. And then it has you ask yourself some questions. What was affected or threatened? Was my self-esteem, my pride, my emotional security, my relationships? There's a bunch of things that I've listed in there. And then it comes to the real meat of the matter on the next page. After building this case on all these people, it says this was our course. We had to see how the people who had wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms, that they, like us, were perhaps sick too. And somehow, inside myself, I had to find enough honesty and enough open-mindedness to put myself in their position and to see if I was in their shoes, how I could have done to someone else what they had done to me. That I get sick like they were sick sometimes. And under the right set of circumstances, maybe these people that had hurt me, maybe I could have done the same thing. Maybe I have done the same thing to somebody else. And when I was able to see that, then I was able to take them off the hook and come back and answer the questions in the last part of the first section of step four. And it's referring back to our list again. We ask ourselves these questions. Where in these situations I've been dishonest, selfish, afraid, where was I to blame? And for the first time in my life, I took the responsibility for every jackpot I'd ever gotten into. And see, a lot of these resentments that I had were very, very well defended. See, part of my own personal dishonesty with resentments is that if you hurt me and you do something very simple, the more I play it through my own mind, the bigger of a villain I make you out to, and the more innocent I make me out to be. And it's never like that. See, I dehumanize you. And the big book asked me to get reconnected and to put myself in this, to see how you were like I, perhaps spiritually sick. And I had to see myself in you. And that was the beginning of a process that I've carried on in the 10th step that has done more for me than anything that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. To know that I am the problem. When I'm resentful, when I have a case going against someone, that it's not them, it's me. That I'm the guy who has to change. And I don't know about anybody else, but I have the kind of mind that builds a case real well against you. It just looks like you. You know, I used to go to my sponsor and I'd have these cases built and I'd tell him what they were doing to me and what. And he'd always say, well, you got to change your attitude. And I want to tell him again. He didn't hear me. You know, it's like, well, wait a minute. They're doing this and they're doing this. And he'd say the same answer. You got to change your attitude. And the great freedom that has come. See, prior to this, I was in a world where my well-being, my peace of mind, and my serenity was contingent on you guys acting right. And I'm a pretty good manipulator. I can get most of you acting right, but there'd be one SOB that would turn on me and ruin my whole day. And the great hope that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me is that I can change me and I can change my attitudes to fit the conditions that God puts down in my universe no matter what. No matter what. and that God will give me the power to change my attitude if I sincerely want to change it. You know, I had a problem with relationships my first few years of sobriety and employment and a lot of the things that a lot of people that I've talked to over the years in Alcoholics Anonymous have a problem with. I was 4.5 years sober, and I was working my 7th job in 4.5 years. Now that doesn't give you a record of a lot of consistency. And I was working this job, and it was the best job I'd ever had in my whole life. I was making $200 a week. I had more responsibilities than I'd ever had. And I remember when I was a newcomer saying to myself, if I could get a job where I made $200 a week, I would never want anything again the rest of my life. Right? I bet you God got a kick out of that one. And I'm working this job, and I've had it for a while, and I started it. It was the best job I ever had in my life, and in a couple months, I couldn't stand it. In a couple months, I started noticing how they were taking advantage of me, how I was underpaid, how I did more work than anybody else there, and nobody appreciated it. There were people there that were making more money than I was, and I did much more than they did. And I worked in a department in a big store, like a big department store. And in the department that I worked in, customers would come in and ask me for stuff, and you know, they just would bother me. I'd be busy doing something real important, like stocking a shelf or something, and these guys would ask me these dumb questions. It's like, what's over there? Can't you see it, you know? And I wanted to quit. And I went to my sponsor, and I told him everything that was going on, and he wouldn't let me quit. He told me again the same thing he's always told me, you got to change your attitude. And I said, yeah, I know that, but I don't know how to change my attitude. And he said, well, you got to change your attitude. He said, you're there to learn how to do that. And I wanted to change this, and I knew he was right, and I knew by now I'd taken a 4-step, and I knew it was me. I knew it wasn't them. Even though on a daily basis my head built a case about how it was them, I knew in my heart, you guys had ruined me. And I knew it was really me. I knew I was the guy that had to change. And I wanted to change. I wanted to change because if I was a young guy, and I'm going to probably have to work for another 30 years, and if I'm going to work 40 hours a week for another 30 years, I want to find a way to do it comfortably. I don't want to be one of those guys that I see in Alcoholics Anonymous that's sober a lot of years and that going to work to him is like doing time. I don't want to be one of those guys sober in Alcoholics Anonymous a lot of years that's sober 25 years and have had 30 jobs. That every person he's ever worked for has been a jerk. I mean, it's either him or he's had the worst luck I've ever seen in my life. And I don't want to do that. But I didn't know how to change. And at this point in my sobriety, I was real involved in general service, and I was asked to participate in a panel in a PRASA up in Santa Clara, California. And at the PRASAs, there are a lot of workshops and things, and then Saturday night they have a banquet speaker. And the banquet speaker was a guy named Chuck C. from California, who died a few years ago. And Chuck had touched a lot of people. And I guess when the student's ready, the teacher appears. And I was ready to hear what Chuck had to say that night. And he talked a lot about God's business and our business. And he talked about being on this earth to be of service. And he said a lot of things. And I went up to him after the meeting, and I explained very briefly the situation I was in. And he told me a couple things that I never forgot. He said, kid, he said, you have it all wrong. He said, you're going to work for the wrong reasons. You got to go to work for one reason and one reason only, and that's to be as helpful as you possibly can to whoever's there. You're there to be of service. What you get paid, how much other people work, and what else is going on there is none of your business. You're to go in there and be helpful. And if you ask God every morning to help you to go in there to be helpful and to be of service, and you keep that up, he says things will change. So I came back to Las Vegas, and Monday morning I got up in the morning, and in addition to my regular prayers and my conversation I had with God, I talked to him about this, and I said, please help me to go in there and be helpful. My attitude stinks. And I went in there and I did pretty good for 15 or 20 minutes. Then they started bothering me again. And I got real discouraged. But I kept it up and I kept it up and I kept it up and I kept it up.
And a few months went by, several months went by, and the next thing I know, I'm going to work and I'm telling people how much I like my job. And I started to feel something in the job that I had never felt anywhere except in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in service. And it's a feeling that I've come to understand to me is more important than happiness. I felt useful. And that's a tremendous feeling for a guy who's been a parasite most of his life. And I felt like I belonged there, and I felt like I fit. And as a result of practicing this very simple principle of Alcoholics Anonymous in my job, I started becoming very successful. Not because I wanted to, it's just a byproduct. And in no time at all, I was the manager of that department, and it led to an opportunity of a guy who had a similar business across town, and he wanted out. And it came to me one morning while I was talking to God, and the thought came into my mind just out of nowhere. Go to this guy and tell him you want to buy your business. The minute I thought that, I laughed. I laughed because I don't have any money. Right? So I thought, well, what the heck. I went to this guy, and he knew me because I'd worked for him for a little while. And I worked for him. I went to him, and I said, I'd like to buy your business, but I don't have any money. And he didn't laugh at me. And he sat down. And he said, let's talk about this. And he came up with a plan. He says, if you can come in here and manage this business and increase the profits so many dollars a year, out of the increased profits, a portion of that will be used to buy you a percentage of the business up to 10% each year. And I had nothing to lose. And I said, okay. And I went to work there, and I came to work every day with the principles that you guys had taught me. And I was there to be of service to the customers and to be as helpful as I possibly can, and to try to treat people as I'd like them to treat me. And at the end of 5 years, I had the option to buy him out. And God has been real good to me. We have a chain of stores today. And I never intended to create, and I didn't create, I never intended to have the kind of financial success I have in my life today. All I wanted to do is I want to be one of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous that when they talk about going to work, they say it with some enthusiasm and their eyes sparkle. I don't want to be the kind of guy that when he talks about going to work like he's being sentenced to go to 6 months in the county jail. I wanted to find a way to be as comfortable on the job as I am in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as a result, I've tapped into a principle that's one of the bases of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the principle of service. And I've come to understand that God has put me on this universe, in this universe today, to be as helpful as I possibly can. That my life is none of my business. And just to the extent that I leave my life alone and show up and try to be helpful to God's kids, does my life improve. And you know something, the opposite is almost always true too. Just to the extent that I start worrying about my life and taking it back into my care and trying to improve it, does it start to turn to crap? And I don't know why that is. And I've, like everybody, I've gone on my own self-will binges in sobriety and almost have destroyed myself a couple of times. But my God is very loving. He just kind of lets me get right out to the edge and then pulls me back. And one of the things that has saved my life over and over again is that I've never failed to be active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I still go to a meeting every day. I sponsor a lot of guys. I go to a lot of hospitals and institutions. I have 3 commitments a week. I'm on committees. I'm an involved, active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my activeness in Alcoholics Anonymous seems to save me from me. See, I'm the kind of guy that if I weren't as active as I was, if it was just me and God alone, we would sit on my living room couch and we would get in a lot of trouble. You know, all of a sudden God would say to me one day, it's probably okay to have a light beer. They didn't have those when you used to drink. But I renew my faith in the God of my understanding by showing up and trying to be a vehicle. And one of the things I say every morning when I get up, I said, God, Help me to get out of myself enough to see the opportunities you put in my life every day to be helpful. And I bet you he puts 100 in my life more than I see, because I'm too busy thinking to notice them. And I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've discovered a principle that I get in my life richness and abundance just to the extent that I'm willing to help God's kids. You know, the takers don't get anything here except alcoholism, and the givers get it all. And the givers get it all. You know, about 8 years ago, things were going so well in my, no, actually about 7 years ago, things were going so well in my life, I looked around and I thought, well, what can I do to improve this? And I thought, I probably ought to get married. Yeah, I think that's the missing piece here. Mm-hmm. And I was dating this gal at the time, and she's a nice gal. And we got married. My sponsor told me about 2 years ago that I probably would have married anybody that was breathing in my local vicinity at that time. And we got married, and we're married for about 4.5 years. And it was a time in my life where I was trying to build this business, and I was very involved in that, and I was very involved in Alcoholics Anonymous at the same time. And we started to have some problems in our marriage. And I knew that a lot of it was me. And I knew a lot of it was because I wasn't there a lot of the time. I was working 60 or 70 hours a week. I was going to 7 or 8 or 9 meetings a week. I was sponsoring a couple dozen guys. I was on a couple committees. And I was almost an absentee husband. And I started to get real concerned about this. And I was sponsoring a guy at the time that was a real close friend of mine. And I used to share, my sponsor wasn't always available, and I used to share a lot of what was going on in my marriage with this guy I was sponsoring. And I talked to my ex-wife, and we decided to go to try marriage counseling, and we tried that for a while. And she just came up to me one day and she said, I don't want to go to marriage counseling anymore. I want out. So I did what people in Alcoholics Anonymous told me to do. I agreed, gave her everything she asked for in the divorce. There was no fight. It was very quick. It was very over very quickly. I tried to turn it over. I approached it with the attitude that if this is meant to be, it's for the best. And if we're supposed to get back together, it'll happen, and it's not in my hands. And we were divorced legally on a Thursday. And the next day, Friday, her and my daughter move in with my best friend, the guy I'd been sharing with that I sponsored through this whole thing. All right. And I found out that they've been having an affair for the last year of my marriage. And I was devastated. I was devastated. And I was so, I think for a period of close to a year, I don't think I've ever been more sick inside myself, more angry, more frustrated, more hurt, and more afraid. I think I was possibly the sickest I've ever been, drunk or sober. And the only thing that had saved my life at that point was that I kept showing up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I kept showing up on a daily basis in my relationship with God. I kept doing 12-step work. I kept doing everything people in AA told me to do. I got to a point I had to stop talking about it in meetings because I was so vulnerable that people in meetings would come up and tell me to do crazy stuff, and I'd just do it, like send them gifts anonymously and stuff, you know, and I'd just do it, you know. My sponsor got me and he said, just do this stuff. Don't listen to everybody, you know, just do. And I got real, you know, there's only one do not in the whole big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's in chapter 5. It says, do not be discouraged. Well, I started getting real discouraged. See, at this time, I'm sober over 10 years. And I'd never been up against anything that was so relentless. See, I'd been up against resentments that you pray for the person, you do an inventory on it, and in a week, at the most 2 weeks, maybe you're over it. And this was the first thing I thought about when I opened my eyes in the morning, if I slept, and it was the last thing I thought about before I went to sleep. And I thought about it all day long, and I could not think about it. And I knew I had to let go of it, but I don't know how to let go. How do you stop thinking about something you can't stop thinking about? And I got real afraid. And something started happening to me that I'd heard a couple people in Alcoholics Anonymous talk about, and I didn't understand when they talked about it. I started getting thoughts about committing suicide. And it wasn't that I really wanted to kill myself, I didn't think that I had what it took to get through this. Because it had been months and it hasn't gone away. And I was tired of hurting. And I was doing everything that Alcoholics Anonymous and people in AA told me to do. And I knew I had to let go, but I don't know how. And tell me something concrete, I'll do anything. And I was doing anything and it still wouldn't go away. And I wrote inventories on it, I did everything. And people in AA that had been through this kept telling me, this is a long process. This is not something you're going to get through overnight. And I kept showing up, and I think the reason I didn't kill myself was that when I was a newcomer and I came off Skid Row, members, dozens and dozens of members of Alcoholics Anonymous spent hours and hours of their time with me, listening to me, taking me to meetings, buying me cigarettes, giving me clothes because they knew I didn't have any clothes. And they poured so much love into me and so much attention that I could not take my own life because I could not do that to you. And I could not be another bad example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that sounds like a stupid reason for not killing yourself, but it was all I had to hang on to. Every time I'd get it about up to here and I just want out, I'd think of all the people over the years, the guys at the men's stag at the lunch meeting that used to buy me lunch when I had no money. And the newcomers that I sponsored, that came and sat with me, some of them would come and stay overnight in my house because they knew I was having a hard time. And I could not reject the love that you people had given me. And so I kept showing up. And what my sponsor and other people in Alcoholics Anonymous told me would happen eventually started to happen. And eventually I started to get more and more more and more comfortable with the situation. And finally, about a year, a little over a year into it, I went back and I did another fourth step exactly like it's outlined in the book. And it was no different than the one I did right after the divorce, except that emotionally something changed inside of me. And you know, I could finally really see at a gut level how I'd set that whole thing up. That by, you know, there's a line in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that says, we make decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. And I made some real bad decisions unconsciously in that marriage. One of them was to get married in the first place. Right? Once again, I was trying to wrest satisfaction and happiness out of my life by my own managing well. And that I was real vacant and emotionally inaccessible a lot through that marriage. And I had put myself in the position where just about nothing except what happened could have happened. I was the major contributor to the whole scenario. And as I started to see that, I started to see how if I was in their situation, I probably would have done the same thing. That they weren't bad people. They weren't out to get me. This was not a personal thing. And I started to be able to take them off the hook. And I'd say for about the past year and a half, I've been real comfortable with that situation. I see my ex-wife, the two of them got married not too long ago, and I was real happy they got married. And he's not a bad stepfather to my daughter. And I go over there fairly regularly and see my daughter, and my ex-wife doesn't go to meetings too much. She's a once a month kind of member. But it's whenever I see her at a meeting, I'm real glad to see her there. Because she has the same disease I have. And they're doing pretty good. And I tell you something, I would have never thought I could have gotten through that without taking a drink. But God has a funny sense of humor. You know, while I was going through that, I think he turned me into a divorced man's magnet for Southern Nevada. If there was a newcomer or somebody in AA that was going through a divorce within 100 miles, they were showing up in my face. Right? And I think they did more to get me through that than anything. And I I really believe in service in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a big part of my recovery. I have a guy that I sponsor who's dying of a terminal disease. And he's already lived a year more than the doctors told him he was going to live. They told him a year and a half ago he had 6 months to live. But God has different ideas. And this guy has become, he's the kind of guy that I never would have drank with. He came from a different walk of life, but I've come to love him very much, and he's become one of my heroes because he does a lot of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. And whatever remaining time he has left, he's dedicated to going to hospitals and institutions in the state prison and reaching his hand out to newcomers. And my friend quotes a part from the 12 by 12 when he talks a lot in meetings. And the first time I ever heard him mention it, it just touched me, brought tears to my eyes. The part's from the beginning of the 12 by 12, and it says that Alcoholics Anonymous is a set of principles, spiritual in nature, that when practiced as a way of life, can not only expel the obsession to drink, but can return the sufferer to a life that is happily and usefully whole. And I watch my friend, who materially has nothing, but has more in his life and more richness and feels happier and more useful than he's ever felt in his whole life. And he's dying. And he's dying, and you'd look at him and you wouldn't know it. And he's happier than a lot of people that I know that have everything going for him. And he's happy because he's found the secret. See, I think alcoholism is a love disorder. And I think people like us sometimes get it backwards. We think if we get the right stuff in our lives, we'll feel whole. If we find the right person to love us, we'll feel whole. And maybe that emptiness will go away. But it's really the other way around. See, because some of us are good enough that we've found the right person and the right people to love us. And the problem with that is it doesn't really help. It doesn't change nothing in here. And we stumble, some of us have the opportunity to stumble on the secret by accident in service to others, in sitting for 5 hours with a guy that's coming off his last drunk. I find something inside of me reaches out and touches something inside of them. And in the process of my loving you, does the hole fill up? And it never fills up for me trying to get you to love me. It only fills up going this way. And I know I've run over. I'm going to tell one thing. I'm going to shut up. When I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a lot of problems other than alcohol. I had warrants out for my arrest. I just came off Skid Row. I had no place to live. I didn't have a job. I didn't have any job skills. I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't think I could stay sober. And I went to a man in Alcoholics Anonymous and I told him all this, and he told me something I'll never forget. He said, first of all, none of that stuff's any of your business. You have one thing and one thing only to concern yourself with, and that's recovery from the disease of alcoholism in the program and fellowship Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said to me, he said, I promise you that if you put as much time and energy into recovery from alcoholism as you used to put into staying loaded and running the universe, that all these unresolved problems will take care of themselves. And I said, okay. And that was my moment of commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous, to put Alcoholics Anonymous as the center of my life. And what I've discovered is that I've only ever had one problem, and it's been a spiritual malady called alcoholism. It seems at times that the problems are relationships and finances and a lot of things. And that I only have one problem, and it's alcoholism. And when I treat my disease of alcoholism, all these other things straighten out just to the extent that I take care of the business of treating my disease. And I heard a story about 12 years ago in AA that I've never forgotten. I like to always close with it. It was a Sunday afternoon. There was a man, he had the day off, and he's sitting in his easy chair in the living room. He's reading the newspaper, and he has an 8-year-old daughter. And his daughter comes up to him and says, Daddy, Daddy, please play with me. And he says, later, sweetheart, I'm busy. I'm reading the paper. And she won't go away. She says, Daddy, please play with me. And he looks in the Sunday supplement and there's a full page map of the world. And he gets an idea and he tears the map out and he tears it up into little pieces. He grabs a roll of scotch tape and he says, "Sweetheart, here's a puzzle. It's a map of the world. Take this in the other room. If you can tape this together, bring it back and I'll play with you for the rest of the day." And she goes off in the other room and 10 minutes later she brings it back and it's taped together perfectly. And he can't believe it. And he says, "My God, what did you do? How did you do that?" And she says, "It was easy, Daddy. On the back was a picture of a man. When I put the man together, the world just fell into place." And if you're new, I encourage you to come with us. And you'll, if you do what we do, you'll find the greatest miracle you've ever found in your whole life. You'll actually see the face of the world change. Thank you.